To build beautiful, active communities in Sullivan County for over 20 years. On Facebook, Instagram, and at sullivanrenaissance.org.
From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Patricia Robayo, filling in for Tim Bruno. On today's show, we speak to Assemblywoman Aileen Gunther from the 100th District about the tragedy in Texas. Did you know we won two awards? We did. Two awards from the New York State Broadcasting Association for Excellence in Broadcasting. One was Outstanding Public Affairs Program for the local edition, and the other, Outstanding Interview for my interview with John J. Lennon on prison journalism. We will rebroadcast an excerpt of that interview. Also on the show, I check in with Grayscale Darkroom in Narrowsburg at the Narrowsburg Union about an upcoming workshop on how you can learn about black and white film photography. And finally, we'll listen to the latest episode of Cooking in the Catskills podcast, hosted by Brett August. This month, Brett sits down with the chef from the new Eldred Preserve. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. Following the deadliest school shooting in Texas history, the National Rifle Association is meeting this weekend in Houston. Former President Donald Trump gave the keynote address. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports on his remarks attacking the Biden administration and Democratic mayors.
Trump claimed that the mass shooting in Uvalde that left 19 students and two teachers dead was a direct result of skyrocketing crime rates, as well as what he called efforts to defund the police. He said he had given Democratic mayors too much leeway to deal with crime when he was president.
But if I ever do it again, namely run for president and win, I would no longer feel obligated to do it that way. I would crack down on violent crime like never before.
Uvalde, which has a Republican mayor, has taken no significant steps to reduce police funding. Police in Uvalde have come under heavy criticism for their handling of this week's mass shooting. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Outside Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, 21 crosses now stand. They represent each victim who died in this week's school shooting, 19 children and two teachers. Across the country, the final funeral from the grocery store shooting in Buffalo, New York, will be getting underway in a couple of hours. Vice President Kamala Harris is attending. Ukrainian officials say their forces may need to retreat from the last territory they hold in the Luhansk region to avoid becoming encircled by Russian troops. Officials say Russian soldiers have now entered the city of Severodonetsk. President Volodymyr Zelensky, heard through a BBC interpreter, says Ukraine will put up a strong resistance.
As expected, the situation is very, very difficult. The occupiers are trying to achieve in at least 100 days of war the goals they hope to achieve in the first days after February the 24th. Therefore, they're concentrated in the Donbas, maximum artillery, maximum reserves. There are missile strikes, aircraft, everything.
Russian forces claim to have captured the city of Lomon, but Ukraine's deputy defense minister says fierce fighting is ongoing. Investigators in Mexico have determined forestry officials began both fires that combined to become the state's largest ever, Alice Fordham reports.
The Calf Canyon Hermit's Peak fire has destroyed hundreds of structures and displaced tens of thousands of people. Forest Service officials said early on that the Hermit's Peak fire began as a prescribed burn, designed to reduce flammable vegetation and prevent larger fires. High winds blew that fire out of control. Now, Forest Service investigators say the Calf Canyon fire also began as a planned burn, which smoldered from January to April before reigniting. New Mexico's governor, Michelle Lujan Grisham, said the federal government should take full responsibility for the extensive damage. For NPR News, I'm Alice Fordham in Santa Fe.
This is NPR News. Iran's Revolutionary Guard says it has seized two Greek oil tankers in the Persian Gulf. In a statement, the Guard did not say why, but the tankers were seized after Iran warned of what it called punitive action against Greece following the U.S. seizure of crude oil from an Iranian-flagged tanker off the Greek coast this week. Greece's foreign ministry says Iran's actions violate international law and amount to acts of piracy. AAA says average gas prices are $1.50 more per gallon than...
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Liam Mayo from The River Reporter. Families across the nation have faced a profound concern in recent weeks, the shortage of baby formula. The shortage stems back to a supply shock in early February and a recall by Abbott Laboratories for its Sturgis, Michigan factory. The Tri-State Pregnancy Center and mothers in and around Milford have used Facebook to connect mothers and hungry children with resources including access priority for specialized formulas, financial aid to offset the cost of formula, and volunteers who collect free supplies. Acting Secretary of State Leigh Chapman issued notice on May 25 that she will order a statutorily required statewide recount in the May 17 Republican primary race for U.S. Senate seat. Mehmet Oz and David McCormick, the first and second place finishers respectively, have vote totals within the 0.5% margin that triggers a mandatory recount under state law. The department estimates that the recount cost will exceed $1 million of taxpayer funds. This is the seventh time the automatic recount provision has been triggered since the passage of Act 97 of 2004, with three recounts carried out and three recounts waived by the second place finisher. And the second public meeting on Pike County's grant-funded trail feasibility study will be held on Monday, June 7. The trail feasibility study seeks to determine the interest, capability, and cost of a trail spanning approximately 14 miles from Hawley Borough to downtown Lackawaxen. This news roundup is produced in partnership with The River Reporter. I'm Liam Mayo.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Patricio Rubio, sitting in for Tim Bruno. 19 children and two teachers were killed in a shooting at Robb Elementary School in Texas on Tuesday. The gunman was able to purchase firearm and ammunition soon after turning 18. After shooting his grandmother, the gunman made his way to the elementary school, according to authorities, and was able to make his way into the school from an unlocked door. It was over 40 minutes before a tactical team was able to take the gunman down. I spoke to Assemblywoman Aileen Gunther earlier on the tragedy in Texas and what she thinks that needs to be done. Here's that conversation now.
Well, to be honest with you, my daughter lives in Texas, and I heard it. I was listening to the radio while I was up in Albany, and when I heard the word Texas, I immediately called my daughter, and of course, to make sure everything was okay there. And I actually was watching MSNBC this morning. And I've been crying ever since to see those children and exactly what happened. And, you know, the fact that this 18-year-old boy turned 18 the day before and he got hold of this automatic gun and he went in and killed all of those children, as well as two teachers. And I'm just devastated. I'm devastated. And, you know, I was listening to the news this morning and they, you know, talked about mental health and, you know, which is the access to mental health has to be improved, no doubt. You know, we've closed beds in New York and I am the chair of mental hygiene in the state of New York. And I felt that the pediatric beds and the adolescent beds they closed, I thought it was ridiculous because, you know, the medication that we use for people with mental health, you know, you have to do observation. You know, the fact is that it's very difficult to get an appointment with a psychiatrist. They're few and far between. Many don't take our insurance. I know that, you know, we used to have a nurse in every school. We used to have more social workers. And I think we have to look at ourselves and see if we're providing the appropriate, and especially during a pandemic, the appropriate care to our children and making sure that they're not only, you know, educated as far as reading and writing and math, but make sure their minds are healthy. And I'm absolutely devastated like every other parent or grandparent. And I can't even imagine what they're going through. I just can't. You know, I'm angry. I can't watch it anymore because, you know, as an empathetic human being, I mean, how can you feel anything? And, you know, again, I know I saw Kathy Hochul was looking to make some changes as far as raising the age from 18 to 21. So we'll see what's going to happen in Albany also. But, you know, it has to be a cohesive message across the country, You know, we are surrounded by Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and we have to stand together. And, you know, my family has been, hunters for years, and it's been a family thing, you know, to get a deer and then they have venison. You know, I know that when Jake and I were short of money and et cetera, and there are many people that use it for food and they're for their families, and I get it. But I don't get what's happening in our country. And I think that, you know, it's going to be bigger than me to address this issue, but we have to address it from every home, every school. Everywhere we go, we have to talk about it. It has to be talked about by our law enforcement. We all have to talk about it and figure out what we can do to make this stop. And how can we make sure that people have access to care?
So you're saying this is not just a one thing that could solve everything. You have to sort of go at it from different angles.
No, I mean, it's not at all. I mean, you have to have access to care first and foremost. And that's true. You know, we've closed beds. You know, I have private insurance and not many psychiatrists would even take my insurance if I went to ask for it. I know I have a friend that, you know, she ran right into that wall of, oh no, I don't take insurance. You have to pay and it's too much money. We have a child psychiatrist in, Sullivan County, and Rachel, she's completely booked for a year because we have few and far between. I do think, you know, they were talking about licensing social workers, and I believe that should happen. They have great training, and I believe that they should license them. Anything we can do to get people in the field to talk to our children, to see if we can change the trajectory of what's been happening now. Kids are suffering, people are suffering, and we've gone through a pandemic, we've gone through family losses, friend losses, and it's time to look at ourselves and figure out, you know, we give money to all these very large corporations, let's give money to mental health and to health in general.
It's very overwhelming watching the news and seeing all that's happened, seeing the tragedy, seeing the lives that have been lost, see how the parents are suffering. It's really a lot.
I mean, it is. And my four granddaughters there, and the first thing I did was call my daughter. And she actually didn't even know it had happened because I heard it right away. And, you know, I'm like, oh my God. And she was like, oh my God. And, you know, once it happens once, you know, there's also copycats. So we're all going to have to be on high alert.
Orange County Sheriff's recently announced that they are offering school districts for a chance to invite them to come over to inspect the schools to see how they would do in a active shooter situation, if their school is safe enough, what recommendations they can give.
There's a big, this is one incident. This is one incident. Rachel and I have attended different schools, and I'm not going to identify any. There are kids that are having boxing matches in their school. There are things that are going on in our schools that we need to take some more money, get those people that our superintendents need in the school to help them, and figure out how we can, you know, get a nurse in the school and make sure that they have what they need to help our children. They've been out of school for 2 years. They're on the internet continuously. The things that I see on the internet knock me out. So I think that we have to gather together as community, in a small community, and then as a state community, and figure out where do we go from here to stop what's happening. Look at Buffalo. Look at Buffalo. Can't even go shopping. I know that Crystal People, she's our majority leader. She came back yesterday. And you know what? You can't help but be a changed person. You can't help. You know what? All of us have to do our part to stop this violence. And we have to talk to our children, our neighbors. You've got to be friends with your neighbors. We don't care about race, creed, color. It doesn't matter. You know what? I'm a person that was brought up Catholic. And you know what? We were all created in God's image and likeness. He left nobody out, and we have to realize that we all are friends and neighbors and help one another.
It's just a tragic situation that happened in Texas, and as more and more information comes out, it just seems more tragic. And you see the politicians arguing about what's going on with gun control and mental health. You see the suffering that's happening, and sometimes for some folks, I would assume, could feel left out of the conversation. What could we sort of do to help this and better this situation?
Talk to your children. Parents, talk to your children. Grandparents, talk to your children. If you're an aunt and uncle, talk to your children. You know, I think that as a community, we have to talk to our children. We have to protect our children, and we have to come together. No race, creed, or color matters. We are all one. And if you believe in God, and we're all God's children.
We'll take a short break. And when we come back, we will rebroadcast our award-winning interview on prison journalism. We'll be right back. This is Radio Chatskill.
This music can reach further than we've ever imagined, into worlds that have so little to do with our culture, the culture of Ashkenazi Jews. The music transcends. It takes hold. Someone hears it, falls in love with it. That's why I'm so happy to share this with you. I'm Aaron Bendich, and I play a selection of Jewish recordings on Borscht Beat on Radio Catskill.
Sunday afternoon at 1.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Patricia Rubio. WJFF Radio Chatskill has won 2 awards from the New York State Broadcasting Association for Excellence in Broadcasting. One was for Outstanding Public Affairs Program for the Local Edition, which airs weekdays at 6:30 on WJFF Radio Chatskill. And the other was for an interview I did with John J. Lennon, who is a prison journalist. I connected with John, and we were able to speak about an article he wrote for the New York Times Magazine about how life was inside the Sullivan Correctional Facility during the beginning of the pandemic. After a couple of email exchanges with his agent, we were able to speak over the phone, and John was very open and frank on how life was inside the prison during the pandemic. And we also spoke about how he became a journalist in prison. John J. Lennon is a contributing writer for The Marshall Project, a contributing editor at Esquire, and an advisor to the Prison Journalism Project. He is serving an aggregate sentence of 28 years to life at Sullivan Correctional Facility in New York for murder, drug sales, and gun possession. But he's also the finalist for the 2019 National Magazine Award in Feature Writing, and he recently wrote an article for the New York Times entitled, "I Am Incarcerated. This is my COVID lockdown story." A look into what it was like to be in prison during the pandemic. I wanted to speak to John to see what was life like working as a journalist inside a prison and how he got into writing in the first place. Yes, John's an active writer, writing behind the concrete walls and barbed wire fences.
Jewel at New York State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
To accept charges, press 1. To record charges, thank you for using Securus. You may start the conversation now.
Hello.
I first asked John, what was the genesis of the article and why he wanted to share his experience inside the prison?
Yeah, I mean, journalistically speaking, I mean, that's the like peg out there right now, right? It's, you know, It's the story that everyone's reading about. It's, you know, what's life like in the era of COVID. I've been writing about it, as you mentioned, for the past year. I was in Sing Sing when it first crept into Sing Sing, which is an older prison on the Hudson, and I covered it for Esquire. I wrote several articles about it. And as you mentioned, it was difficult, to be fair, for corrections to sort of wrap their head around how they were going to sort of keep us safe. So it was a little more intense when I was in Sing Sing. About five people died, four prisoners, one corrections officer. It's an old prison. We live on top of each other. And so when I got to, so I wrote about that. I'm sorry, it was just the officer here. They're just checking. I'm in the yard just to set the scene for the listeners. on a phone, you know, guys are jogging. It's a brisk night, you know, sunny, tower in the distance. So when I started writing about this back in Sing Sing, the response was officers and, you know, docs was having, you know, a difficult time, as I mentioned. And then it quelled. It kind of ran its way through Sing Sing, as I mentioned. There was deaths, and then it quelled for a bit, and then the summer came, and I was transferred out, and I was transferred to a smaller prison here in the Catskills, Sullivan. And you know, COVID, the coronavirus hadn't quite really reached its way to the northern prisons yet. So, to your question, the sort of genesis of, or the reason for writing this, it's all about, you know, I had a colleague that was working at the New York Times Magazine, and they were looking for pieces on, you know, on COVID. It's all networking, this freelance business. So it was basically, you know, it had hit Sullivan in the second wave had come, and and they sort of locked the cell block down. At this point, to be fair to corrections too, they kind of had their acts together with PPE, and they had a plan for when the second wave was going to hit. But the piece was basically just about the 30-day lockdown in the cell block, and what's it like for guys living in a cell block when COVID comes, and you have a cast of characters, and you tell your tale.
The one thing that I took away from your article that was I wasn't expecting to, obviously the life you're living in prison is very different from anybody who's experiencing COVID outside the prison. But what it was struck me was that it was sort of a lot of the same things that you were experiencing there was happening in the outside, as far as you know, scrambling for masks, the fear. You talked about the fear of this virus and who's contracting it, and how, you know, your other prison mates were getting sick, and you were nervous. You were talking to your mother, encouraging her to get it. Obviously, it's set in the prison setting, so it is different. But I what I took away from was a lot of the things were the same that a lot of people were experiencing out here, sort of the same sort of themes.
Sure, yeah, look, people are people, you know. I mean, we're locked down, you guys are locked down. Even my editors, while writing this piece, and, you know, they were asking me, like, do you feel a certain way about this lockdown that's so ubiquitous now? Everyone's saying lockdown, lockdown. And, you know, it wasn't like I was, you know, it wasn't like we in here are sort of resentful to you out there because you guys use the word lockdown. We get it. It's a scary time right now. It's not like we're like gripping the bars and, you know, telling the world, you guys don't know about this real lockdown. I mean, it's just, you know, we have fear. We get anxious. We make jokes. We have fun. We're, you know, people are people. Some of us, you know, committed some terrible crimes. It was everyone's got their own story. You know, everyone's trying to overcome whatever they did. Some people did some terrible things out there, and, you know, they're the worst thing that they did is not really known. You know, we're people in prison, but people are people. So, I mean, when you tell stories about characters, I try to, you know, humanize, you know, my peers, but it's kind of easy, you know, because, you know, I know the different facets of the characters that I'm around.
Now, you began writing in prison, and I was reading about the Columbia Journalism Review article that came out about you, about how you got into writing. And for the listeners who want to see that, you could visit their website at cjr.org. You started writing in prison after taking a creative writing class. Is that correct?
Yeah. It was back in 2010. At that point, I was in Attica. I was about 9 years into my sentence, you know, the first couple of years, you don't know what the hell to do with yourself in prison. You kind of find yourself, you try to find yourself. There's not much opportunities going on in prison. There's a lot of incapacitation and just nothingness. TVs in the cells, a lot of politicking in the yard, and it's really tough for guys to sort of find some type of, you know, something to sort of, you know, do with their lives, frankly. And by 2010, I was in Attica. And Attica's a pretty rough joint, but there was a little glimmer of hope in Attica. There's always pockets of rehabilitation in prison, even in the worst of prisons. And I was fortunate to find that creative writing workshop. And in prison, whenever there's something good going on, it's not like everyone's saying, "Hey, there's something good going on. You guys gotta get down with this." And everyone like keeps it to themselves. And I was just fortunate that somebody invited me to that workshop. One of the guys that was there, and this guy Doran Morrison, he's an English professor, and he was coming in teaching. He just showed us what good writing looked like. You know, we read Best American Essays, and you know, I saw where these pieces were published, and I was like, "Wow, this is the real deal right here." The Atlantic, New Yorker, New York Magazine, New York Times Magazine. Like, these are the holy grails. Like, this is. I remember telling him, I was like, "Well, I want to send my stuff there." Like, how do I? You know, and he kind of looked at me like, "Well, you know, let's just focus on the." Task at hand right now, but yeah, it was that's where I learned how to write. He showed us what good writing looked like.
Now, did you have any experience or any kind of artistic endeavor before prison, in any capacity?
No, I came to prison like with a ninth grade education. I was just a drug dealer at I grew up in a housing project. My mother kind of wanted the best for me. She sent me to different schools or whatever. But, you know, I had my own, I screwed up, you know. I mean, I had this void, and my father killed himself, all that kind of stuff. And I went out looking for this kind of lifestyle, and it was the lifestyle at that point was very attractive to me. I grew up in Brooklyn. We moved to Hell's Kitchen, and I hung out with a crew of kids that I thought were really cool. And, you know, I became a criminal. And you know, I got everything that life had to offer, including 28 years of life. So by the time I came to prison, you know, I was kind of like a high school dropout. I had like a ninth grade education. I always loved story. I didn't realize how complicated it was to tell those stories. But when I sort of got into that workshop at Attica, that was like the first time I got to sort of like, learn what it entailed. And, you know, that's kind of...
Yeah, and as a writer myself, as a reporter, writing's not easy. It's not the easiest thing sometimes. You know, you have so many words in your head and to get it on paper, and then, you know, it's a really rough draft in the beginning, and then it's just a whole bunch of revisions after that. When I was reading this, it's first thing is, how long did it take you to write this article, and how did you write this article? I think in the Columbia article, it mentions that you do have access to a typewriter. Was that always the case? Were you always writing on the typewriter, or were you handwriting it and submitting it, or what was that process like?
You know, so back when I was, you know, freelancing articles in the beginning, like my first piece I published when I was at Attica in 2013, it took months to write that first sort of op-ed. I first got published in The Atlantic. And, it's just very hard. It was just I could probably whip up a piece like that, you know, much quicker. I mean, I'm working on a piece right now for the Times, another op-ed, but it's, you know, it gets easier, but it's always hard, right? But to answer your question about the logistics, yeah, I mean, you in the beginning, you don't have any network, you know, you may have a girlfriend that, you know, that may be annoyed that you're asking to, like, you know, like email some editor that you don't know, and it's tough to sort of get this network from prison. But landing pieces from prison is about building relationships too, and it's not, that's just any freelancer can relate to that. But to answer your question, like, yeah, I mean, I write initially on my typewriter, and then, you know, when I didn't have contacts, I would, you know, sort of blind submit finger scroll down mastheads of different magazines and go for it. That first clip I had in the Atlantic kind of helped me because, you know, maybe it opened editors, it raised the eyebrows of editors, like, wow, this bum was published in the Atlantic. He may be able to write something. Like, so it kind of, like, the clips kind of helped you. But with this, but fast forward to 2021, with the New York Times Magazine piece, I mean, it was on a serious deadline. You know, the characters were, I have JPay now too. So JPay helps me. It's a tablet that, not a really popular company because they profit off of prisoners and people aren't too thrilled about that. But, you know, it's an added way of communicating with our loved ones. I use it for both. I communicate with my editors and my loved ones, and it allows me to cut and paste and to send manuscripts to my editors. So to answer your question, I thumbtacked that 5,000-word piece in the New York Times Magazine on my little JPay tablet, and I went back and forth for a couple of months with my editor about, I don't know, maybe 10 drafts, and it was pretty intense.
No, it's like I say, it's a powerful piece, and gives great insight of what happens, what's life like in the prison. You writing, I'm sure it helps your time in prison. It gives you something to do. It gives you, I guess a reason to do something during the day. This is what I take from it. This is what I imagine from a person who's in the outside who's reading this and looking at your history and seeing this and saying, wow, like, this is his thing. And this is what keeps him busy and he sort of keeps him alive mentally and your soul in prison. Am I wrong in that?
Yeah, I would say all of the above. You know, I'm incredibly grateful for this career that I've built for myself. But I would say it's a career. You know, I earn income. I write stories. You know, I'm a contributor, to Esquire and to these places. And I've been fortunate to build a career for myself. So it's about identity too. Like it's 7:20. So like, I remember in a piece last year or year and a half ago, I wrote, it was more of a reckoning sort of piece I wrote for the Washington Post magazine, and it was trying to come to terms with my crime. And, you know, when you write a personal essay about that, you know, it's about identity, you know, and I was writing it from a place where I had developed this career, but it's about am I the murderer or am I the writer? And, you know, when we write personal essays, you know, it's a self-realizing, we try to figure something out, right? We're trying to sort something out, I'd like to think. And with me, it was about identity, and it was about, you know, coming to terms, trying to apologize for what I did. But it was also about identity in the end. And, you know, who am I? Am I the murderer? Am I the writer? And, you know, I'm both. You know, I think we're a sum of all of our deeds, right? I think Bryan Stevenson likes to say, oh, we're more than the worst thing we did. I think that's I think he's encapsulating a lot there, right? I think when you are, you know, somebody that's, you know, stepped over that line and you've taken a life, I think, you know, and then I built this career for myself, that's a constant conflict, right? There's a lot of conflict with this career in prison, you know, but because in some sense you represent your peers, and sometimes you don't always get it right. You know, sometimes, you know, you kind of looked at sideways by guys, and I get that. I get where that comes from, and sometimes they have a point. I learn from my peers, you know. So there's a lot going on with this, to your question. You know, it's more than just, you know, something to do. It's, you know, it's my calling.
We'll be right back after a short break. We get to talk to Crystal Groh about Grayscale Darkroom's upcoming workshops. This is Radio Chatskill.
The new Pike County Humane Society is a safe haven for pets to ensure animals are given the best opportunity for adoption or fostering in Pike County and all over northeastern Pennsylvania. Open house Saturday, June 4th from 12 to 4 in Shohola, featuring tours of the shelter, special activities for kids and adults, food, and all the animals waiting for their forever homes. More information at the new Pike County Humane Society's Facebook page. Paid for by WJFF listener support.
Hi, it's Rachel Martin with NPR's Morning Edition. As you've no doubt heard, listener support makes public radio possible. But here's something you may not have heard. Public radio stations around the country raise millions of dollars each year from the sale of donated vehicles. That's right, vehicles of all sorts. Whether they're running or not, they can be turned into support for public radio. That vehicle you no longer need, here's how to donate it to support this station.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Patricio Rubio. Graysdale Darkroom at the Nowsborough Union has an upcoming workshop on how you can learn about black and white photography. Grayscale Darkroom and Photo Lab, Sullivan County's only publicly accessible analog photography lab and black and white darkroom, was recently awarded the Arts for Sullivan Community Grant, which helped make these workshops possible. The first workshop begins on June 4th. I got a chance to speak to Crystal Groh, owner and founder of Grayscale Darkroom and Photo Lab, to find out about what this workshop is all about and what Grayscale Darkroom is all about. Here's that conversation now.
So, you know, Grayscale Darkroom and Photo Lab is, you know, a full-service black and white photography facility. And, you know, I've been open for about a year now and have been able to, you know, process film, and I've had people in for some private lessons, but what I really haven't had the capacity to do is to host workshops with more than one person at a time, you know, due to limitations of space, but also because of COVID. And, you know, winning this grant through the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance and Arts for Sullivan has given me the support that I need to be able to purchase cameras that people can use when they come to take this workshop. So we're not expecting everybody to show up with a camera in hand. It allows me to purchase film that people can use for the workshop. So we're not expecting anybody to already come with film. And it also allows me the ability to bring in some teaching artists. So each session of the workshop will include, you know, a guided photo walk in downtown Narrowsburg, you know, where people will not only have the opportunity to photograph what they see, but to get some guidance from somebody who has been photographing. And I think that's really important. And I think that's what makes this special. You know, there'll be the technical side, which, you know, I'll teach people what film is and what the chemicals do. But to have that additional inspiration and guidance, I think, is really, really critical and really is going to help make this a really special experience for people and an accessible experience for people, because black and white darkroom photography is not the most accessible art form one could be sort of undertaking right now. So that's kind of what we're here to do.
So who should be taking this workshop? What are the sort of the skill levels that could take this workshop? Are you going for the absolute beginner, or can a person who's familiar with film photography and how to develop film could also take this workshop?
The idea is for this to be accessible to people sort of at any level, you know, to someone who maybe was in a photography program in high school, but, you know, hasn't been able to photograph for a while, to somebody who maybe used to do analog photography but switched over to digital, or to someone who just, you know, found their dad's camera in the attic and wants to know what to do with it. I think the idea is that this can appeal to everybody. And that's the idea. You know, we want to be inclusive for people at every sort of stage of skill and interest to further develop those skills, pun intended, or to, you know, or to inspire them to do more. You know, I think there are a lot of people who are interested in traditional darkroom photography, but just don't really have anywhere to practice it and don't have the kind of support of an artistic community that maybe other art forms are have around here. So that's the goal, is for this to sort of appeal to anybody at any level, and for them to still walk away with something, whether it's just a roll of processed film or a new take on how they want photography to be a part of their life.
For those attending the workshop, what kind of darkroom skills will they be learning? Will be developing film and printing, or just developing film?
So the workshops that we're doing here, they'll be over the course of 2 days. So the first day will kind of be like the classroom day. People will come in. I'll go through sort of a syllabus with them, talk to them about composition, about lighting, about f-stops and apertures, and show them how to load the film into the camera. And then they'll go out and shoot a whole roll of film. The next day, people will come back and we'll do a sort of one-on-one in-person session in the darkroom, where I will walk people through the process of developing their own film. So at the end of the course, people will walk away with a roll of film. For this workshop, I'm offering people sort of the option to book an additional printing session at a really, really discounted rate, so people could come back on their own time and work with me to make a contact sheet or make a print. But, you know, I wanted to offer people the option to go that far if they want to, but I also didn't want to make that mandatory, you know, like people, if people aren't into it, you know, because I know that too. Some people will get in here and be like, well, this is fun, but that's enough for me. But yeah, we want to give people the option either way. So, but after the two sessions, I think people are probably going to want to come back to print, and they can work with me to come back, because I also want people to feel comfortable and have enough knowledge to come back here and know that this space is available to them as a resource if they get really into it and want to start making their own prints and shooting more film. We want to become that resource for a photography community here in Sullivan County.
I'm sure folks will love to learn the process of actually making a photograph and what it goes into making or creating a film photo, because you're talking about developing, using different chemicals. Now in this age where everything is modern and everything is instant, there's such a time it takes for those things to, for lack of a better word, to develop. I know when I've done darkroom printing and printed a photograph, and to see it for the first time, when you're looking down at the tub and seeing through the chemicals, and you watch that photo just appear, it's like, to me, when I could remember, it was like magic to me, for lack of a better word. It was like magic to see that photo just appear right before your eyes.
Yeah, no, it's true. And it's funny you say that kind of magic, because that's what people say when they have that experience in the darkroom for the first time of making a print, to just drop the paper into the developer and watch it appear. It is. It's like magic. But when you also have someone there who's guiding you through the entire process, you know, to really be involved in everything from the moment you put the film in the camera to when you compose your shot and you press the shutter and you process the film and then you make your print, you're so invested in that process, you know, and I think that's something we've gotten away from a little bit with digital photography. You know, there's certainly a value in it, and it's revolutionized photography and made it accessible to everybody. But I think at the expense of that feeling of investment in the process. You know, you can take 1,000 photos on your phone when you go on vacation, but you might never look at them again. I just came back from vacation and I have about 25 rolls of film to process. But I know, you know, going through that process, because it means a lot to me, and it feels more permanent. So you have that connection to the images and you're seeing them all the way through. And it's exciting to me. It's inspiring to me. And I just want to be able to share that with people as well.
My experience with film cameras, having used them and now have used digital cameras, is that the film cameras really allows you to slow down and, you know, so be sort of conscious of what you're taking, because
you only have a very limited amount of photographs you could take on a roll. And you mentioned just traveling just now and bringing your film. And I remember those days that you had to sort of pack your film in x-ray bags so they won't get damaged in transport. And you haven't taken photographs in your vacation. I'm sure you had a different experience with the vacation afterwards or when you develop your film. Because, you know, we think about which when it was a normal thing to take photographs on film, you would take photographs, you would have to come home, have them develop, and then it could be a couple of days, couple of weeks until you actually see the photographs. And nowadays, you know, everything is instant. We take a photograph, we post it online, we post it on Facebook, Twitter, and, you know, instant reactions, and everything's in real time. So we sort of lost that experience that was before with the analog world and having that reliving of an experience of you had and sort of, like I said, picking your moments because you have a limited amount of photographs you can take.
Yeah, I completely agree. And, you know, it is a very different experience and it kind of serves a different purpose. You know, the other thing about sort of slowing down and really thinking through what you're photographing is that on the other end of it, when you process, you learn from that experience. If it doesn't really work out, if it's the composition wasn't quite right, your exposure wasn't quite right, you remember that and you learn from that and you take that with you the next time you're photographing something. And that's how you develop a style. That's how you come to understand what it is you like to shoot. And you have so many more options, you know, with film and with cameras, you can decide whether you want to shoot color or black and white or 35 millimeter or medium format or large format, 4x5. You know, you have all these opportunities to make different creative decisions than you would if you were taking a picture on your phone and it's just going to do the same thing for every single photo, you know? So that's something I really like to tell people in these workshops, really, when we're thinking about the difference between analog and digital, it's more than just what you're using to shoot on, you know, whether your phone or a camera. It's all of these other creative decisions that go into one frame when you're thinking one frame at a time. I'm excited to be able to share that with people and so grateful to have the support of the DVAA and Arts for Sullivan. You know, we're the only people sort of doing this in the area, and it feels really good to have some backup and for the local arts community here to back us up and throw their support behind us and believe that this is something that people would be excited about. So I'm really excited to bring people in and share all of this with them.
And those who work in analog film and who are interested in working in that, you know, it's great to know that there is a place that's near us, that's near home, that we can go to. So we don't have to go to further up north or down south to the city and have those experiences. And, you know, so it's really grateful. It's really something to have this in Sullivan County.
Yeah. And that we can sort of meet people at whatever level of interest they have. You know, if somebody just wants to drop off their film, I'm happy to process it for them, you know, and if that's where they're at, that's awesome. We are here for that. If somebody wants to learn how to do it themselves, if someone wants to be making their own prints, we're psyched to be able to support them too. You know, if somebody's looking to apply to a photography program for school and needs help putting a portfolio together, you know, we want to help people at that point in their process. So to really, truly be able to open the doors, and I think these workshops are a really good starting point to kind of introduce people to the process and then let them decide what their level of involvement is and let them know that we can be here wherever, whatever level that is.
Right, right. Do you also process medium format film?
Yeah, definitely. And that's what I mostly shoot is medium format 120 film, which talk about how many frames you get on a roll. Usually I get about 10. And that's enough for me. I feel like 36 exposures is too many. but, you know, that's how I've been shooting for a long time. And that's how I've sort of figured out what I like to shoot. I don't move quickly. I don't do like street photography, photojournalism style stuff because it feels too fast for me. I like to really slow down and take my time and take, you know, big landscape portraits or just things that I find interesting that I can stop and spend my time with. but that's also not everybody's style of shooting. And 35 millimeter works great for people that want to do candid or live action stuff or sports or music photography, you know, but it's also kind of the most accessible way to get started. So we've got some cameras in. I've got some really good loaner cameras in 35 millimeter that people can use for the duration of the course, which is really huge. And I think is really critical to getting people involved in the process. You know, we can't expect people to have the equipment already. So being able to provide loaner cameras was a big part of what this grant allowed us to do, and something that I wouldn't have wanted to run the workshops without. So that was a big hurdle that the grant made possible for us, and also being able to supply film. So it's a, yeah, it's sort of an all supplies included. You can show up with nothing but an idea and be on your way.
Now, like I said, the first set is the three sessions. First one starts on June 4th, and they happen over 2 days. If folks are listening to this and interested in learning more or learning how to sign up for one of these workshops, where can they go?
They can sign up online through the website at grayscaledarkroom.com. So there's a workshops section you can click on and sign up for the workshops. So right now, each workshop is limited to 4 students each. So, you know, we wanted to keep the class sizes small. So, like I said, everybody could have access to a camera if they needed it. So everybody got a good amount of time with the teaching instructor. And, you know, so everybody could have that one-on-one processing session. So four participants each, but you can sign up online, yeah, at grayscaledarkroom.com, and also find out more about private lessons, about renting the dark room, and about the other things that we can offer to people that are interested in engaging in photography this way.
Thank you so much to Crystal Grove talking to us and letting us know about the Grayscale Darkrooms workshop that are coming up. They start on June 4th. For more information, visit grayscaledarkroom.com. We'll be right back after a short break, where we find out what Brett August has cooking up in his latest podcast, Cooking in the Catskills. This is Radio Chatskill.
On the next Folk Plus, songs about guns, gun dealers, the Second Amendment, and kids with a gun.
He's an okay student, he comes from good seed. He's never been in trouble, what more do you need? He's somebody's baby, somebody's son. He's a kid with a problem, he's a kid with a gun.
Views expressed are those of the artists.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Patricio Robayo. Celebrity chef Brett August has a podcast on Radio Catskill, Cooking in the Catskills podcast. Brett explores the best eateries in Sullivan County and gets to speak to their chefs and see what makes them tick and why they love to cook. Cooking in the Catskill podcast can be found on WJFF Radio Catskill's website or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. This month, Brett sits down with executive chef for the new Eldridge Preserve, Dan Gonzalez. Here's an excerpt of the latest episode of Cooking in the Catskills, where Brett asks Dan, who is a native to Sullivan County, how he got his start.
Well, I was born in Sullivan County. I was born and raised in Liberty, New York. And I actually started cooking with my mom in the kitchen, you know, at a young age. And I decided, you know what, let's go to culinary school and make this thing happen. So my first culinary job was at the old Eldred Preserve. I started out as a busboy, and I was there for about 4 years. And I worked my way all the way up to line cook. And then from there on out, it's been one heck of an adventure. I went over to the Lazy Beagle for a while. I worked there. And from there, I went to the Center for Discovery and Mr. Willie's at the same time, back and forth. And then when Mr. Willie's closed down and the casino opened up, I jumped ship from the center. I went over there and started out in Double Top. I worked my way all the way up to executive chef in Chelayo and Dos Gatos. And when the Eldred Preserve was reopening, I said, you know what? Sometimes you just got to go back to where your roots started and sink ship home there. You know what I mean? And that's what I did.
Really cool. So you started off cooking with your
your mom basically at a young age, and that's how you got your love for food and just working in the kitchen, doing these great things. Is that how that happened?
That's exactly it.
Really cool. What type of food were you cooking with your mom?
Oh man, I don't even know. It was dinner. That's all I could remember. It was just dinner back in the day, you know?
Those are great memories though, right?
Oh yeah. You can't beat those.
Tell me about the place you're working now, Eldridge Preserve. Tell me what you got going on. Tell everybody how beautiful this place is, what the grounds are like, what you can get there, and just tell me a little bit about it.
The grounds are beautiful. I mean, absolutely beautiful. But you just got to look at it for yourself to even understand how nice they are. And, you know, the preserve, we've only been open a year, really. In the next couple of days, we'll be open at 1 year. We're still trying to figure out our feeding and go with that. We are probably, we're the old homestead, you know, that's our main go.
Tell everybody a little bit about the old homestead. I don't know if a lot of people know about that, but tell everybody a little bit about the homestead. I grew up eating there with my dad, the history about that, or just what that's about.
Well, I really don't know much about that. I was a little young when they were in their heyday, but they were the hottest place in Sullivan County for a long time.
Oh my
God. They were doing their own thing and just people were just nonstop in and out of that place.
Lobster tails, fillets, baked potato. I remember as a little kid seeing lobster tails the size, you know, I used to think they were like the size of a football. They were so delicious. It was amazing. Yeah. Place. What's on the menu at the Eldridge Preserve? What do you like cooking? What do you really enjoy cooking the most?
I don't really know because I never really had like one specific genre of food that I stuck with. I tried to take it all in and learn as much as possible. So I never really enjoyed cooking one thing all the time. You know, it is nice to throw a steak on the broiler though and just wow people and how fast you can get one done and get it to the temperature that they like. That is always a fun thing to do.
It'd be so amazing if everybody could come in and see the size of the broiler you have in your kitchen.
Yeah, and if they could feel the heat that's pouring off of it too.
Oh, it's insane. I love going in there. You guys are getting a super great vibe. Everybody's talking about you. I suggest everybody make their reservation. You guys are getting super busy. I mean, you're doing 200, 300 covers on a Saturday night. It's great. It's a great feeling. The town totally needed something. You're a great chef. You're doing great food. The farm that you guys have behind Bethel, that's amazing. So you're growing your own microgreens. You have your own lettuces. You're doing all these great things.
Yeah, our owners are awesome. They are definitely trying to bring back what the Catskills once were in the best way that they can. And yeah, we have our own farm, which is absolutely amazing. There's nothing better than a nice fresh salad from the preserve because it is grown from the farm and it is picked hours before you are eating it.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's really cool. Awesome. I can attest to that firsthand. I've been in your walk-ins. I've seen your meat. I've seen everything. What can somebody expect when they come into the Eldridge Preserve? I mean, besides the ambiance, it's absolutely beautiful. I mean, but what can they expect? I mean, what do you suggest? A strip, a ribeye, the piano guy playing? I mean, what's that all about?
Well, on Saturday, we actually have a live piano, a pianist. But throughout the week, we just have a automatic piano, and it's really cool. It plays off of CDs. It's really old school. It works so nice. It's so cool. It's a nice vibe, you know. But
at Sunday nights, you were telling me you guys are starting something else, right? You have a, a cabaret night you have going on?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So in the next upcoming, I don't remember all the dates, but on every Sunday, we're either going to do a cabaret, a comedy show, a live entertainment. It's going to be cool. I think it's like every other Sunday. I'm not positive. I forgot the dates right now.
What, you know, I interview a lot of people and most of them aren't from the area, but you are from the area. So you've seen a lot of change and you've seen restaurants go up, restaurants come down. You've cooked at some really good restaurants. You know, I sell food, so I'm hearing all the buzz that's going on. And you know, a lot of people talk about you and, you know, it's really great.
You can listen to the full episode on Cooking in the Catskills podcast, which can be found on our website, wjffradio.org/podcast, or you can find them wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Remember, you can hear this episode and previous episodes on our website, wjffradio.org/podcast. And while you're there, check out our other podcasts. I'm Patricio Rubio. Thanks for listening.
WJFF Jeffersonville, Radio Catskill, public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org